Welcome to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. The lives of lesbian, gay, bisexual, transsexual, queer, intersex, asexual, and all other gender fluid peoples, or what we call the LGBTQIA plus peoples, are challenging throughout the world. On one level, the recognition of rights and protections of the community is growing, but the threats are still very real. And the political campaign to reverse some of these rights is quite powerful. On today's show, we will explore the challenges the LGBTQIA plus community faces internationally, as well as in their own countries. We will survey the main issues throughout the world, and we will discuss the international and domestic implications of raising the profile and removing the invisibility of this community in our conversations about global politics. Our panel today is S.N. Nayak. She's an associate professor of Africana Studies in the Department of Ethnic Studies at the University of Colorado, Boulder. She's the author of Africana Queer Presence, Ethics and Politics of Negotiation. Nick Mule is professor in the School of Social Work and the School of Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at York University, Canada. He is the author of Mental Health Issues and the Needs of LGBTQ Asylum Seekers and Refugee Claimants and Refugees in Toronto, Canada. Manuela Peak is a lecturer in the Departments of Political Science and Sexuality, Women's and Gender Studies at Amherst College, and professor of International Relations at Universidad San Francisco de Quito in Ecuador, though she's joining us today from Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. She's the author of Vernacular Sovereignties, Indigenous Women Challenging World Politics, and also with Marcus Teal, Sexualities in World Politics, How LGBTQ Claims Shape International Relations. And our fourth guest is Marcus Teal, Associate Professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Florida International University in Miami. He's the director of FIU's EU Center of Excellence. And along with his book with Manuela Peak, he's the author of The Politics of Social In and Exclusion in the EU, Civic Europe in an Age of Uncertainty. Nice long introduction because we have some extremely prolific authors looking forward to today's conversations. Manuela Peak, I'll ask you first. What ultimately is the status of the LGBTQIA plus community around the world? Is it fair to say that protections are growing, or is it still a community that's quite a bit at risk?
I would say that the rise and the acceleration of the rise of authoritarian regimes everywhere in the world is putting at risk LGBTIQ members, communities, individuals. And I think the risk expands beyond the political and the social, the publics and the commons. It expands also in private spaces, so-called, like academia, right? The case of the invasion of Ukraine maybe was a sign. It's not only that we had an autocratic government, Putin's government invading Ukraine, right? The narrative of the other, the dehumanization of the other, the threat of we're invading Ukraine to normalize Europe, right? To bring back the good family, to end with this export of homosexuality, right? To all the corners of the world, is something that comes embedded. So the more we have these invasions, and Gaza is only the latest, but we are seeing an acceleration of war and violence and authoritarianism, comes with this narrative of otherness. And it comes with bodies that are criminalized, and the first bodies to be criminalized are LGBTIQ bodies. And these bodies are not just being criminalized on the front lines and dehumanized on the front lines. And as in the case of Ukraine, not only you have the Putin's narrative coming in, right, to dehumanize you and putting you on the line, you have the martial law that impedes you to dress as women, to leave the country, right? What happened to trans women when men have to stay in the country and go to war and go to the front because that's what men do? It reinforces borders, and it reinforces the not only the dominant masculinity, but the violent masculinity. And this is being transposed to other spaces like academia. We're seeing ever more tensions, and the need to bring LGBTIQ bodies and representation to the forefront is all the more urgent every day.
As a Nyack, I know you done your work in Africa and the presence of the LGBTQI plus community in Africa as being more recognized, both academically as well as politically, et cetera. But there's been a lot of attention paid to areas in Africa where protections are definitely under fire. So how important are some of these threats across Africa and the growing visibility of this community in Africa?
Thank you, and thank you for inviting me. I put Africa in four quadrants. The reality is that in Africa, you found countries that adopted legislations criminalizing homosexuality between men and women. And these are inherited from the colonial time. That is one group of countries. You have other countries that, having inherited these laws, have gone ahead and revised them and decriminalized them, meaning rejected them. You also have countries that never had any written repressive laws. And in the fourth quadrant, you have those who, having inherited something from the past, from the colonial past, are thinking that that is not enough. So they've gone and try to increase penalty and repression. Having said that, that is the picture I have now. That some countries get more attention than others is not necessarily reflective of what is going on in those countries, let alone in Africa. So my reading, I'm not going to cast this debate in terms of hope versus despair, but I want to think this is a dynamic issue that is going to see shifts that are going to be recognized as positive, and in some areas, and in others, they are going to be recognized as conservative. So it's going to be a melting pot of a little bit of this and that.
Yes, absolutely. And Marcus Thiel, you wanted to respond as well.
Thank you. Thank you. Just to continue on that, I think what Essan said was very, very well put, because I think there's really, it's not black or white, right? If we look at the past 20 years, there's 50 shades of gray, just to use a really bad metaphor. I think we've all been around long enough to realize the amount of changes that happened over the past 20 years, right? I mean, if you're just thinking about, same-sex marriage did not exist anywhere, right? Pretty much 20 years ago. And now we have this trend, proliferating widely, even to non-Western locales, right? As an IR scholar, I always like to, see it, on three analytical levels: the individual level, the state level, and the international level, right? That's sort of like the basics of our analysis in international relations. And sort of in the individual level, if you look at public opinion attitudes, they have been slowly, gradually, incrementally, but surely growing more, tolerant of LGBT plus populations, right? State levels, yeah, it's very different. But even there, we've seen, in the UN, for example, we've seen in general non-discrimination, moving around the globe. Of course, the last decade of geopolitics has also sort of driven that sort of anti-Western position, right, against, homophilia and so on. And then globally in the UN, I mean, we have now a UN independent expert, right, on sexual and gender identity. So there's, exactly. It's not just hope and despair. I think it's sort of a back and forth. And part of the pushback or the backsliding that we see right now is because of the success of the past 20 years.
And Nick Miele, work that you've been doing has been connections with asylum seekers. So international presence in a country like Canada. I know Canada has a pretty good record with international advocacy and certainly domestic issues, but some of the challenges that asylum seekers, that immigrants to Canada are facing as they leave their own country and try to seek out potentially a country that's going to be more supportive.
First of all, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here. And in answer to your question, there are a lot of challenges refugees and asylum seekers who identify as being part of the LGBTQ plus communities face. And I'll start by just saying, with regard to these particular populations, and I've certainly researched beyond them as well in terms of these communities, meaning the LGBTQ plus communities internationally, is that when you have refugees and asylum seekers seeking to resettle in your country, that is a very clear message that there are problems in our world, and they're very serious. And for many of them, it would not have been their choice to have come. It's because they're being forced, they're being pushed, they are under persecution in their home country, and they are in great danger. And so we should never lose sight of that. And I sometimes am critical internally here in a country such as Canada, given the progress we've made, is that there's a lot of Canadians who can be very friendly and very open-minded and have open arms with regard to these populations coming in, and then quickly believe that, well, they're here now, they're settled, and everything's okay, everything's fine, and that problem's solved for that individual or those groups of individuals. When in reality, it isn't. First of all, resources are really lacking. The resources that do exist, especially in mainstream service sectors, they are not prepared for these populations. They are not well trained. When they arrive as well, they're not necessarily located in urban centers that have more LGBTQ plus friendly services. And so they have to travel long distances to get to them, if they're going to get to them at all. We should never lose sight of the effects of seeking asylum and trying to get refugee status, having left one's home country, one's family, one's friends, their career. It's very traumatic for a lot of people, and trying to resettle is not that easy. And so 2 points there. I mean, one being, it sends a message to how serious matters are in different parts of the world, that people need to escape just to survive. And then secondly, where they land, is it a haven or is it not? And many of us believe that there's a lot more that can be done, even in a country like Canada, in receiving these populations.
One thing I really want to avoid on today's show is to paint this picture where you have global north countries that are quite supportive of LGBTQI plus rights, global south countries, you know, much less so, that there's this division within the world that's easily described that way. But I do know that in Africa, critics of LGBTQI rights and protections tend to blame colonial experiences, and that this is not a natural state in Africa. Those are more political arguments, I would imagine. How embedded, how common is not the right word, how much of a part of African experiences, and I realize saying African experiences is extremely, you know, experiences. So can you give some examples of how this is really just not something that flows from the global north to the global south, but it's actually quite natural in Africa?
Well, let me first start by saying that I would argue that everywhere somebody's trying to blame someone else. Western Christian Europe, as far as I know, certainly revert to nature as, you know, imagined by God, and probably blame the devil for non-conformist witchcraft oriented and all of the Satanist bending type of sexuality. So it's not inherent to a specific region. The fact of the matter remains that colonialism was real. Some people might think it is still going on. And therefore, as much as some people may feel uncomfortable thinking about that, unfortunately, that is a legacy that we cannot just throw off or away or pretend it is not there because we're trying to rescue a queer self. Having said that, I think it is a bit of a narrower approach to understanding anything. And Africa is certainly the most diverse, or one of the most diverse continent, given its massive landmass. The truth is the following. Even we go back pre-colonial Africa, you would find society that, first of all, everywhere, by and large, you will find queerness almost everywhere. And let me explain what I mean by that. I think queerness as understood in the West, or with the rise of gay liberation, et cetera, has, for better or worse, fixated on sex and sexuality. But I find that maybe contextually or provisionally understandable, given, you know, the HIV epidemics and all of that, you know, we know the story. But queerness in Africa, I think what I call queerness is more of a different way and vision of understanding the real, right? Because the question, the problem with Europe is not just sex. It is actually the mental framework with which you have been trained to understand the body and sex and all of that, right? So this duality that you have inherited is certainly there and explaining why rigidity is in your own understanding of gender. So when I say queerness is really pervasive in Africa, what I mean is that from the cosmology to myths or and this and that, you see a lot more fluidity. But here is the tragedy. Precisely because colonialism is not just about extracting diamonds and this and that from Africa, it was also about condemning modes of thinking, and primarily condemning modes of thinking. That's why colonialism can end, but Christianity, if you read, pick up any book, ooh, Africa is booming. It is the region of hope. This is the future of Christianity right now. Why? Because people still go to church, and elsewhere that is not the case. So this kind of violence of vacating really our imagination, that is where the problem is, because I don't think that if we were to reconnect with ourselves, we would be thinking along the lines of God didn't create Stephen, but it did, you know, Eve and Adam, you know. So that is the prime of an epistemic violence that we are going to have to recognize. And this is also a dilemma. It's not a dilemma for me personally, but here comes the problem of ethics. How do you do queer studies? How do you speak a language? How do you frame a conversation with the intention to be understood, not to score political points, right? Not to talk about, oh, the Human Rights Convention says this. I'm not against that. But if that is not what, if that is not the language that people understand, the challenge is how do you create that language? And you cannot do that by starting from a point of view of moral superiority, or thinking that we have figured that out. You know, unfortunately, that is also there. Just because you are queer doesn't mean that you are certainly interesting as a person. You know, so that is the complexity with dealing with Africa, is that Africa, to do queer study responsibly, you have to look at queerness as an identity of the whole continent in some ways. Then as you descend to a different level of analysis, find whatever you think is queer. So you are always dealing with some kind of double citation, or at least double challenges there. And we cannot do one without the other. So I have to criticize my friends in the West and, you know, do it gently, and as well as I criticize my own traditions and do it gently, because my concern is that I want to be understood and help us figure out a way out of these battles of words.
And you listen to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We're talking about LGBTQI+ communities around the world, what this means for global politics, what this means for questions of identity. Our guests today are Essa Nieck of the University of Colorado Boulder, Nick Mule of York University in Canada, Manuela Peak from the Universidad San Francisco de Quito in Ecuador, and Marcus Teal of Florida International University. And Manuela, I know you definitely want to respond to that as well. And I thought that's going to be a natural transition to your own thoughts, especially because you and Marcus wrote this book on how LGBTQ claims shape international relations. And I'm sure a great deal of that's at that epistemic level that SM was just talking about.
Yeah, listening to Asanyak, I'm just reminding the colonial archives from all over the Americas, actually, not just South America, from the Arctic to Patagonia, passing through Central America and the Andes. Report after report in colonial archives says they're all sodomites, right? Which goes back to this, it's the whole continent. It's a form of exercising authority, right? It's this need of the dualism of the boundaries, the borders, right, that are separating various forms of authority. And you, as early as the early 1520s, you have Spanish conquistadores putting entire groups of people led by their authorities to be eaten by the dogs because they were dressed as sodomites. But it's not really the sexuality the problem, it's authority over territory, right? So it's about erasing one form of authority, erasing sovereignty, exercised in the body and on the territory, with the narrative of sexuality, right? So then you have manipulation, a use, an instrumentalization of certain forms of sexuality being criminalized to justify the erasure of entire nations and cultures, right? So it's in a way from the start, sexuality, from the colonial start, right, of the encounter with the New World, sexuality is used in combination with territorial dispossession to establish sovereignty. So it's really what we're talking about here, the need to be understood, the desire to be understood, or the desire to not be understood, to not translate, and to be lost in translation.
Also, Manuel, I want to follow this up too, that we have this tendency to focus on sexuality, but in particular, I think the recognition of the trans community is very much a suggestion that it's less necessarily about sexuality and much more really about the body itself, about control of the body itself. So I guess two questions. One, how much does the increasing visibility of trans issues direct us away from this question that identity is driven by sexuality and sexual desire, and then just a recognition about fluidity of these concepts?
Yeah, there is the question of whether sexuality is something that you are or something that you do, whether it's something private or something political, whether the private can be unpolitical. And if you go to the Amazon, deep into the Amazon, there are many, Amazonia is the region in the world with more isolated languages everywhere. And you have languages like Ticuna, for instance, that have words for various sexualities and various sexual behaviors or practices, which I don't want to say identities because they're not necessarily perceived as identities in Ticuna language, right? But what we would call LGBTIQ exists in Ticuna in their own terms, and it exists in Cherokee, and it exists in Waurani, and it exists in so many indigenous languages. So there's nothing modern about it, right? What is interesting is to see how now those narratives are being used, for instance, by Israel, embedded in narratives of modernity justifying colonizing the savages who are homophobic, right? In Gaza, for instance. So it's never dissociated from territory, and the body is the first territory.
Yes. And Marcus, it seems then, since I know you do this work with the EU and the way the EU has advanced you know, some of these issues, the bit of a complication here then, because you've got the EU with a history of colonialism and advocacy for protecting communities, and then it's being charged with, but this is language that was used in support of colonialism. How challenging is that?
Thank you. Yeah, indeed, it's quite challenging. And that's why, you know, the title of my book is sort of The Promises and Pitfalls of the EU's International Promotion, right? Because while the EU may be sort of a fairly strong international promoter of LGBT rights, they do so also exactly with the baggage that comes as being sort of assembling the world's foremost colonizers, right? You know, they are, together, they're the largest official development aid assistance providers in the world, but all of this aid is also conditioned upon very Western, you know, style human rights clauses. And so you can imagine that that's not only a curtailing of a country's sovereignty, right? Newly gained sovereignty in many cases, but it also exactly then runs against some other different cultural practices. And so for the European Union to come in and say, like, we may cancel your aid if you don't respect, you know, sort of the LGBTI rights, right, the way that we want them to have, that is very problematic, for sure. And I'll point that out. And then the other point, of course, we cannot forget the European Union is also a market, first and foremost. It's a single market instrument, right? So a lot of, you know, the human rights always come secondary. And how can an organization that is primarily, you know, a neoliberal market be sort of the provider, right? Suddenly become the provider of rights. And you see this in bilateral exchanges with Global South or global majority countries. You see this also with the unfortunate elevated status that the European states have, for example, in Geneva at the UN's Human Rights Council. And so many scholars have actually, you know, the European Union should rather tone down, right, and lower their profile rather than heighten it, because that visibility is very ambivalent in that sense.
And Nick Muley, I want to bring you in as well, because I know you've written about these conversations at the UN explicitly. And so how much has the UN been driven by Global North or European activists and the perception that that's how the UN is being used versus voices coming from colonized communities on this specific issue of LGBTQ rights?
The history of LGBTQ plus activism at the UN has been, and the progress there has been checkered, right? There have been various levels of progress and various levels of setbacks. And as we all know, a lot of that's driven by geopolitical initiatives and nation states coming at things from different perspectives. And the UN is a very complex global setting. The kind of negotiating and backroom activities that take place can really make someone feel very jaded in looking at human rights development in such a setting. But it is the reality, right? It is the reality. And so it can be quite checkered. I think what definitely needs to be highlighted is that anything that has happened at the UN has been driven by LGBTQ plus people themselves, right? It wasn't like diplomats or nation state representatives or what have you woke up one day and say, oh, you know, we should add this to our agenda. No, it was pushed. It was, you know, it was a hard push and a lot of hard activism that has taken place by these activists. Now, you raise a really good question, Douglas, around, you know, but what drives that? Is it coming from the West? And I think to some extent it is. But in saying that, I mean, when I say to some extent it is, it kind of goes back to what we just heard Marcus say with regard to the EU. I mean, oftentimes the money has to come from somewhere to bring these voices forward, because it's literally impossible to have them come to a place that, such as the UN, coming from the repressive states they come from. There are no resources, right? So the money has to come from somewhere. And in essence, it comes from the pockets of the West. Now, to what extent does that define the agenda? And I've been, you know, I've had a lot of questions raised with me with regard to that and read criticisms on this, is that credit needs to be due to those voices that do come from the so-called Global South. Yes, they may need to use the resources of the West to get to where they are, but I've seen this, I've witnessed this, I've in my research, I've seen the voices of communities that and countries and nation states that are really repressed come forward and be able to shape that agenda and speak to their own cultures and argue and fight that, you know, you're not going to present it this way because it's not our reality. Right. So those are hard battles internally that take place, and they need to be credited for that. And the other point I want to make, too, is this conundrum of concept and practice. And I think, Douglas, you were touching on that a little earlier. And that is this notion of queer. Right. And, you know, even the title of this talk, right, queering you know, the kind of the global environment and stuff. And this conundrum with regard to concept and practice is a difficult one. In the theoretical world, we've had queer theory dominate sexuality studies for some time now, 25 years, 30 years, three decades. And it's a theory that has eschewed identity and really highlighted fluidity, which is important to a lot of people. And that's very key. And yet queer theory has not really and never really did offer us practical means of how to address that, right? Because if you're going to try to affect change through policies, through treaties at the international level, you have to name what you're fighting for. You know, you have to be able to say that, you know, at minimum, that this is about same-sex desires. This is about gender identity and expression. And my own theoretical development work around queer liberation theory, I'm also under a challenge of using a word like queer as part of the name of the theory, right? So, but that is the conundrum. That is the thing that on the one level, we need to be very open to what Asen was talking about in terms of how people conceptualize their sense of sexuality, their sense of gender, without necessarily taking it on as an identity. But at the same time, how to articulate that when you are trying to affect change so that you better the lives of yourself and your communities.
So Asen, you wanted to respond to that as well.
Yes, I wanted to comment a little bit on this. The economics of queerness or queer liberation or queer rights, what have you. I want to say first and foremost that queerness is nobody's financial business. It costs absolutely zero. Because I personally, I do not understand. You and I are neighbors. You mind your business. You raise your children. You send them to school. They get jobs, they get sick. They're just regular folks and Joes and Janes in the society, right? So what is the burden of queerness? I really do not understand. Okay, having said that, there are cases that might require medical intervention and other things, but even there, right? Even there, at the end of the day, if you empower people to have decent jobs, to have healthcare, right? Whether the system is public or private, the point is that everybody will be happy. So I want to untie actually this idea that queer rights in Africa or elsewhere demands funds. Because if you were to calculate the amount of money poured into Africa for the queer rights, if you were a country, if you were, let's say, a president of that country, you should be voted out because you're kind of committing a financial crime against humanity. Because you will not make sense of how can you invest this much and get this little. It doesn't make any economic sense. That's the point. So what we are talking about is not more money somewhere. What we are talking about is change, is metamorphosis, is a relational thing. And that doesn't need Macron or Bush or Biden or whoever to facilitate that process. I personally do not understand the connection, right? And the problem of debt is one now where you see the benefit of doing to at least upholding some kind of intellectual honesty, because the debt of Africa is the only thing that explains why we are even talking about foreign aid. How can you aid somebody who's rich? That is not possible. But it is possible because on the left hand, you can sign contracts for 90 years, let's say in the case of France and Niger and so many Francophone countries, to say, hey, I'm going to be buying this preferential treatment for my companies, there is no free trade, right? So you tie African countries, you know, in these sort of deals in the name of free trade internationally, but in practice, no, it is about French companies owning all the business in Niger. Let me remind you, talking about international relations, that when President Bush wanted to sell the war in Iraq, he talked about, they smell Bin Laden over there. We saw it over there. The last straw, the thing he said that convinced every single body in this person, in this country, including the media, was when he said, now we know for sure. He went to Niger and bought what? Uranium. Oh, absolutely. When you say Niger and Africa, that would be true. Except I didn't hear one single news outlet in this country say, hold on a minute. But if that is true, it means he should have bought from the French company who have concessional rights. And that was, whoa, let's go and have a war, right? So here is then the complication. Because when some people talk queerness, they want me to come and talk about what is happening with your sex and your hormones and whatever. Personally, I do not care. Because if you had the minimum of a decent life, you would take care of it without any political involvement. The problem is that Africa is impoverished with the left hand deals, and then on the right hand, we're trying to fix it. How is that possible? Many people don't know that there are countries, all Francophone countries, are not financially free. Every single dollar, every single international transaction that comes from Senegal, Cameroon, Mali, Niger, Burkina Faso, go through the Central Bank of France. You tell me, people, imagine American, United States, every single thing you do go through the Bank of England. Would you tell me that you are independent? Would you be concerned about going to England and fighting for queerness? No, I would say let's break the bank first and see what happens. You see, this is where we cannot disentangle this idea of international rights of queerness from the core concern of Africans, Asians, Latin Americans. We cannot do that and maintain some level of honesty. Therefore, queerness for us cannot be limited to this thing you call sex. Sex means I eat, true or false? Are the queers in the United States lawyers? Yes, they do. Where are the lawyers elsewhere? Because you said, no, don't educate your people. Cut the budget. How do you expect us to do differently than insult you 24/7? Because that's kind of what we do. We are left off. So this is the complication. Where is the honesty? We talk about querying, but querying, meaning asking the question. Who in the so-called international queer movement is not talking about condoms? And even when they talk about condoms, they have no clue about the procurement of condom and what it takes. So we are reduced to this kind of low-level consumer of I don't know, whatever falls from the master's table, when that is not what we should be talking about. So where are those voices? Where are the questions? Who is querying?
And with that, we're going to take a quick break. When we return, we're going to actually address one of those core questions, which is in addressing the questions of LGBTQIA plus communities. Should the focus be on protections like human rights or questions of empowerment? SN certainly suggesting that power plays a substantial component in all of this and what that means in terms of specific policies, protections, empowerment, visibility. Please stay tuned. Welcome back to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. On today's show, we're talking about the LGBTQI plus community globally, talking about the challenges these communities face and ways in which we can ensure protection, empowerment, thriving, visibility, et cetera. Our panelists today are Essen Yek. She is the Associate Professor of Africana Studies in the Department of Ethnic Studies at the University of Colorado Boulder. Nick Mule. He is professor in the School of Social Work and the School of Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at York University in Canada. Manuela Peake, senior lecturer in the Departments of Political Science and Sexuality, Women's and Gender Studies at Amherst College and a professor of International Relations at the Universidad San Francisco de Quito in Ecuador. And Marcus Thiel, associate professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Florida International University. Manuela Peake, I'll lead and ask you this question. There's always a conversation about, you know, communities, you know, that have faced risk, marginalized communities, et cetera, how much the focus should be on protection, emphasis on questions like human rights, or instead think about questions of empowerment, or in some cases, just leaving the community alone and letting the community thrive. What's the best way to approach this?
You know, this notion of protection is who's protecting who from what. And as I was listening to Essen Yek talking, I was thinking of Josie Tikuna, who's one of our colleagues and in activism and in scholarship. She's from the Tikuna Nation in the Amazon of Brazil. She's a leader of homoaffective rights and relations in the triple border between the Brazil, Colombia, and Peru. And she's been criminalized, harassed, received death threats from evangelicals. But really, the evangelicals are in alliance with the miners, right, who want to take the territory of their nation. And three months ago now, they actually came. She wasn't home. They killed in brutal ways her brother-in-law and nephew. And the women in the household were able to escape. And now they're all hiding the entire house. And of course, this is a story that can sound like, oh, the evangelicals are trying to kill the lesbian. But that's a very Western narrative, right? Because who are the evangelicals there and why are they there if not to grab territory, right? And who are the evangelicals and the miners who are trying to grab territory working with, if not with the state and the police, right? And this is embedded in an economy of extraction to export to Europe, because all of those are minerals that go to Europe, to Canada. So we have to keep the international picture in mind to understand who is suffering aggressions, and why are certain aggressions framed as sexual aggressions if they're really about extraction of life, of territory, of minerals. and it's the constant question, the who is being protected by whom. We took her, she went to Brasilia, she looked for safety with the Brazilian government. They said, we have no possibility of providing any security to anybody in that area of Brazil. First, because they have more guns, more power than us. Second, we have, I forgot how many, but 2-3 police stations in the entire state of the Amazon. So there is virtually nothing that can be done with the official means of security, right, of protection. So we're talking about international NGOs yet again, right, who come with these narratives. They don't like to use the narrative of lesbians because that's something that was entered in the territory with the evangelicals, right? That has a negative connotation. So they talk in different terms about it. And for them, it's not about the sexuality. It's about the family relations that are held, the community relations that are held, among other things, through sexuality, right? But it's the relationship to land that's being disrupted. And this forced migration to go back to refugees, forced migration, forced dispossession, forced exile, and the destruction of memory. What we're seeing in Gaza now, right? The bombings on the mosques, it's cultural genocide. It's happening in so many ways. And the body and sexuality is one of the places where it happens. But it's not about destroying that. It's about grabbing the land. It's always about grabbing the land. And the land is not being grabbed by that state or by that culture. It's being grabbed for the outside. It's international political economies of dispossession, which of course are racialized because race is part of the invention of race and the implementation of race, racial categories and structures is part of the dispossession.
And Nick Mule, you had talked about the importance of communities advocating for themselves. And so if you're talking about dispossession of land, impoverishment, exploitation of resources, et cetera, that ultimately the empowerment of communities for forms of resistance, whether that resistance is the advancement of their ability to live their lives, live their truths, or resistance in a lot of other forms. That would suggest empowerment, figuring out ways to empower communities to drive the agendas themselves and their own voices, and that those of us, you know, in the global north, the best we could do is offer alliance rather than direction. Has that been your experience, the conversations at the UN, that's the way that's been framed, or is there still quite a bit of paternalism?
I think we've had to learn our lessons over the decades. I think mistakes were made in the past by well-intentioned activists from the West that overstepped their boundaries, imposing what they thought would be most helpful, and not being respectful or sensitive to the realities on the ground of who they were helping. So those lessons had to have been learned. I think people are more sensitized to that, but I think it's something that we just have to stay very cognizant towards, because it's so easy to make that mistake. The issue of protections and empowerment, in my research and talking to people from around the world, some of what I hear from them, many of participants in my studies, is that it's very hard to feel empowered without protections in place. And inevitably they do go back to issues of human rights, right? The issue of whether that's through policy, whether that's through legislation, but a formal kind of recognition that they believe will protect them more so than what they're currently facing when they are completely unrecognized in policy and legislation and denigrated for being who they are, right? So it's kind of hard to tease that out for a lot of people. And so it is an issue. It is an issue that, there can be empowerment from the ground up in terms of communities, and many, many brave communities and very repressive settings are doing just that. And I think, that's great in many ways, and yet it can be a very dangerous thing also. And yet I've talked to people as well who kind of resort to a very personal empowerment, where they are in settings that are so repressive that it's not possible to assemble. It's not possible to congregate and to come forward with a unison of voices, which in many ways can be seen as a very Western thing. I mean, because, we have the freedoms to protest in the streets, and that's not the case in many other settings, right? And so a lot of people will resort to a kind of a subjective approach of creating their own lives and living their own lives and resisting and rejecting the narrative that is imposed upon them, either by the state or by social norms or what have you. And so in many ways they say, we are living in a bubble, but it's our way of surviving in very, very harsh repressive settings.
So Marcus Thiel, a number of the Global North countries are a lot less committed to LGBTQ rights than what we're presenting in the US and across Europe. How much does that alter our conversation about empowerment and protections, et cetera?
Absolutely. Thank you. And Europe is also a pretty large area, right? If you think about it. And even within the EU27, you have varying degrees of commitments to LGBT, gender, right? Refugee rights, as everyone knows. And so sort of this is another added little problem, if the EU basically sells this normative power Europe package that they like to portray, right? In sort of very self-referential and self-serving manners to the rest of the world. But then there is an incoherent application even within the region. But I think that incoherence really pales in comparison to sort of the mistakes that are being made in sort of, negotiations with the global south, right? Because, as an pointed out earlier, you know, like you, it's, and Manuela as well, it's the political economy of dispossession, right? The European Union, you know, buying off, you know, the fishing rights in front of the West African coast, and then wandering and trying to keep out refugees that move north, right? I mean, literally a couple of years ago, the EU-Africa summit, there was sort of this tense exchange whereby Martin Schulz, the European Parliament president, admonished the European state leader, right, for their, you know, degree of LGBT rights. And the African leaders responded back and said, like, how dare you, right? You're basically killing off, you know, our people at your borders. And you're telling us, you know, like that we're the people with insufficient application. So that's so much for that. Now, with regards to empowerment, again, yeah, that is a problematic problem. I think empowerment is a really important base. But as you know, as somebody, as a Europeanist, empowerment is often understood, or the first thoughts are like, okay, exactly, who's paying for that empowerment, right? And that goes back to what Nick says, you know, a lot of northern states. So there's an ambiguity in making use of the money, even though, right, it comes with condition, it comes with certain, yeah, it really does come with conditions. But it's an important base. And one more thought about the empowerment that I wanted to get through is that I think, you know, it's really important. We shouldn't just focus on LGBT plus rights, right, per se, but really have to also keep in mind the broader social justice movement. There's a lot of, you know, the refugees affairs. It's environmental justice. It is indigenous justice. I think it builds broader coalition that then in the end, hopefully will create, you know, so, a sort of more equal and just societies that will serve everyone rather than sort of a, you know, what I always feel is a marginalizing focus on specific particular demographics. I'll leave it at that.
Absolutely. And our last question, I want to direct this to SN. Spoke a great deal about the ways in which these issues are driving a lot of other issues that at the core is lack of empowerment, questions of colonialism, questions of domination, et cetera. So in speaking of empowerment across all of these lines, certainly, of course, changing the banking, it would be an essential part of that, as you highlighted. But are there other things in particular to the LGBTQIA plus community that would be about empowering a community to enable their own protections?
It is commonly said that to whom a lot is given, a lot more is required. In my experience, what is actually true is to whom nothing is given, a lot more is required. And that is not a way of blaming the victim. That is just to recognize that there is something about victimhood that can teach us something else. That is the power of resilience. There is really not an empowerment that is exogenous coming out of there. That doesn't exist. Or it does with a quid pro quo, especially between states. There is no such a thing as a benevolent state. Having said that, in the modern world we live today, of course, law and international treaties, they matter, but they matter more for less powerful countries. What is interesting is that suppose a gay Nigerian happened to land in France or the United States. From where we are seated, we would say, okay, you are protected. You are given a space to let your gayness and queerness shine. Wonderful. There's nothing wrong with that. But what is not being talked about is how are you simultaneously not empowered? Because that gay Nigerian is going to encounter something called, let's say, racism, which he never knew in Nigeria. And if you were really to listen to that person and say, are you free now? Are you happier now? They would say probably yes, but it is a matter of degree. My point is that let us afford Africa and the developing world degrees of freedom, if not self-autonomy, but degrees of autonomy, recognizing that it is in that, I like this line by a famous singer, the cracks lets the light in, you know, Leonard Cohen. We have to believe somehow in this little crack, in that little tiny, you know, ray of light. Those who Christians may like to remember that light is kind of the first thing to be created. But this is a funny thing about light. It's not a ruler. It bends. So let us have the courage to bend, to be curious at best. I'm curious about this. Now, I want to talk about the African Charter on Human and People's Rights. What I like about it is that it has two languages, discourses that are, I think, mutually reinforcing. One is the human rights, but there is also duties. In the West, we have vacated this idea of duties, except if you are kind of a certain kind of liberal, you know, or you only see yourself. But duty is another way of speaking a language that we Africans understand. It's not because we are slave to people. No, because we are fundamentally relational. Duty is another way of claiming belonging. Not because you are being cited as being recognized by this abstract thing called international law, but because your kin, your neighbor, your friend, your society has recognized you for something that you can contribute to.
That is a great way to end the show, to get us all thinking about duties, thinking about connection, thinking about questions of identity, and most importantly, the duty we all have to continue this conversation and learn so much from one another. Thank you all very much for joining us. We've been talking about LGBTQ issues, empowerment, understandings, et cetera. Our panel has been Essa Nieck, Associate Professor of Africana Studies at the Department of Ethnic Studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder, the author of Africana, Queer Presence, Ethics, and the Politics of Negotiation. Nick Mule, Professor in the School of Social Work and the School of Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at York University, Canada, the author of Mental Health Issues and the Needs of LGBTQ Asylum Seekers and Refugee Claimants. Manuela Peake, Senior Lecturer in the Departments of Political Science and Sexuality, Women and Gender Studies at Amherst College, and the Professor of International Relations at Universidad de San Francisco de Quito in Ecuador. She and Marcus Thiel are the authors of Sexualities in World Politics, How LGBTQ Claims Shape International Relations. And Marcus Thiel has joined us as well, the Associate Professor in the Department of Politics and International Relations at Florida International University and the Director of FIU's EU Center of Excellence. Thank you all very, very much for joining us.
And that's it for today's program. Thank you for listening. The Scholar Circle is hosted by Doug Becker. Its managing producers are Ankina Agassian and Melissa Chiprin. Mahika Chechi is our assistant producer. Seth Dongre is our webmaster and assistant producer. Our archives are at scholarcircle.org, and our podcasts are on Apple and Google Podcasts and iTunes. Please follow us on @ScholarCircle or me @Armudian and join our Facebook page. I'm the founder, anchor, and occasional host, Maria Armudian.